This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Jonathan Engel received his BA from Harvard University, his MBA from the Yale School of Management, and his PhD in the history of medicine from Yale University. He has served on White House medical advisory committees and various other health advisory boards. He is associate provost at Seton Hall University, and he lives in New Jersey, where he joins us on the long line from his office. Brian, Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I know you are a busy man right now, from one interview to the next, and we just want to thank you here in Virginia for making some time for us.
Sure. Charlottesville is one of my favorite places. I grew up in Washington, D.C., and I used to go down there to hike in the Blue Ridge Mountains or just to go visit Monticello or whatever else.
Terrific. Excellent. Now, the your latest book, which I'm holding right here in my hands, is The Epidemic, and it's a global history of AIDS. Before we get into the book, give folks a little Jonathan Engel 101, just so listeners know who you are and how you got into this project, which I'm guessing there's a huge backstory to this book. This is a massive, massive undertaking.
Not so massive. I made the strange decision when I was young to go do a doctorate in the history of medicine and science. It just was something that interested me, and at the time I was too young and foolish to figure out how to make a living. And if I could do it all again, I don't know, if I had a trust fund, I guess I would do it all again. It's a very interesting thing to spend your life researching and teaching. It's not a great way to make a living. But it answers the kind of questions that I tend to ask, which is I look around the world, and I'm always, like all of us, I want to understand why the world looks the way it does and why things don't seem to make sense. And different people have different ways of answering questions, and the way I always find satisfying to answer questions is to look historically, to try to figure out what people were doing when and why people made decisions at various junctures in time, and did those decisions make sense in that time, and what was motivating people. And often, even though the world doesn't look like it's very sensible today, if you look back 20 years ago or 100 years ago, that the decisions which led today actually were very sensible decisions at their time. So it's just a very satisfying way for me to look at the world. So that's how I wound up being a historian. I've always been interested in America, and I've always been interested in the history of medicine and science. And AIDS was sort of the scourge of my generation. I'm in my 40s, and I really came of age into young adulthood just as AIDS was really emerging. And it dominated the headlines through my early 20s. As a young single person, it was one of the things you thought about a lot. And now that I'm at a later point in my life and career, I was curious to look back and try to figure out who did what, when, and how the disease got the way it is today, and what sort of things we did right and what sort of things we did wrong. And we did a lot right and we did a lot wrong.
Jonathan, how many people, if we could just start with some basic numbers, how many people have already died from the HIV virus, AIDS, and how many are still walking around there, out there, infected?
Sure. Probably about 20 million people have died so far from AIDS. And altogether infected were, upwards today of, I suppose, about 200 million people worldwide. It's very hard to get good numbers because we don't know how many people are infected in East Asia and Central Africa and the ex-Soviet Union. And the big mystery is China, actually. We think there's actually a relatively large AIDS epidemic in rural western China. The Chinese have been absolutely mum about it. They barely admit that they have a problem.
So 20 million people have already died of AIDS, and we're looking at ballpark 200 million people who now have the HIV virus, and it could be a lot more.
Yeah.
My God, that's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. It is and it isn't. It's unbelievable from just a raw human tragedy. On the other hand, I'll sort of throw some other figures at you. The world has 6 billion people, so even if all these people died, it's still a relatively small percentage of the world. By contrast, the Black Death in the 14th century, we think, wiped out a third of Europe. So relative to that, this is not, we're not talking about depopulation here, although small parts of the world are going to become depopulated from this. The worst parts of the world right now that are hit with this is Central and Southern Africa, and the worst countries that are hit down there have AIDS rates of 25% to 30%. So you're talking about a country that's going to lose a quarter of its population over the next 10 years.
And we're talking about a whole generation of children.
A whole generation of young men. In fact, there's all sorts of odd tragedies that come out of this. Obviously, besides just death and the loss of loved ones. ones. For example, there's essentially an epidemic of orphans right now running around Central Africa. I mean, huge numbers of kids, unprecedented number of kids have lost both parents. And because these are poor countries, they don't have the infrastructure and the resources and the orphanages and the placement systems to take care of these kids. And these kids are running around, and they're being co-opted by gangs, and they're sort of being raised in a very antisocial and aggressive way. And there's a huge fear that even if these kids don't get AIDS, that in 20 years from now, you're going to wind up with a kind of a whole portion of your population which was never socialized to be adults.
And they are just perfect for these private militias, which roam around the continent in Africa, and perfect. Let's face it, they're perfect terrorists. I mean, you know, if a terrorist organization reaches out to these kids and says, "Here, come in here, we'll clothe you, we'll feed you, and we will indoctrinate this entire generation of children in Africa."
That's right. So I mean, it's another part of the tragedy. I mean, but part of the tragedy is the people who died. The other part of the tragedy is the people who are left alive. All these stories about women who lose their husbands in Africa, and then they're left absolutely homeless with no way of supporting themselves. So even though they're alive, they're really barely living. They have no way of supporting their children. It's just that the tragedy goes on, and it's something that. Although in this country we've so long focused on the American epidemic, the U.S. epidemic really doesn't look much like what the epidemic in the rest of the world looks like. We've actually been very lucky in this country. For all the people who've died in this country, we managed to get a hold of it. We managed to control it. We have just unusually innovative medication, which has been incredibly effective for all. It's not perfect, but it's really been a miracle for many, many people. And we've really stopped it in this country. There's still a small portion of the population that has AIDS, but it's not growing. It's plateaued out. It's actually declining somewhat.
Really? Wow.
And the people who have AIDS in this country, for the most part, are being treated, and they're living with it. It's not perfect. Don't get me wrong. You don't want to get AIDS.
Yeah, yeah.
But you can survive with it. You can survive. People have now survived for 10, 15 years with it.
Yeah, well, my cousin is one of them. I was shocked to learn years ago, a long time ago, that my cousin Greg down in Atlanta had HIV.
Yep.
And yet he's doing great. He looks great. He's got a job. But does he take drugs. I mean,
he takes a lot of drugs. And what you don't know is he may have all sorts of side effects. I don't know just about your cousin, but in general, people on these combination therapies, they have diarrhea, they have shakes, they have chills, they have cramps. Many people feel very enervated, so they take testosterone to try to get their energy up. It's not a way that you and I would want to go through life. On the other hand, it's a heck of a lot better than the alternative.
Right, right.
Unfortunately, that's really only a very small portion of the epidemic. If you look at what's going on in Africa, mostly Africa, but also somewhat in Asia, none of these people can afford these drugs. In this country, these drug regimens are roughly about $10,000 a year, mostly covered by insurance. Well, it's mostly covered by insurance. Listen, what would you pay to stay alive?
Yeah.
There's been a huge push to get these drugs produced at cost generically, and in fact that's happening right now. There are Indian companies. There's actually been a big debate whether or not we should be producing these things at cost or letting private, these kind of pirate generic drugs come out. But even at cost, with no royalties, no profits, there's still minimum $300 to $400 a year for a course of these drugs. And you're talking about countries where annual per capita income is as low as $500, where healthcare spending is under $5 per person. For these countries, a $400 drug regimen is absolutely untouchable. You know, they just can't touch it. So essentially, to have AIDS in Rwanda or South Africa or Zimbabwe is to die. There's nothing they can do for you.
Medical historian Jonathan Engel is our guest this hour on Charlottesville Right Now. The book is The Epidemic, A Global History of AIDS. Jonathan, where do scientists now believe that AIDS came from?
It's a good question. We have a lot of consensus, although for a long time there were a lot of arguments. AIDS is caused by HIV, the human immunodeficiency virus. HIV is very closely related to a much, much older virus called SIV, the simian immunodeficiency virus. The SIV has lived in monkeys for probably the better part of a million years. Estimates are anywhere between 400,000 and a million years. And SIV is what's called a successful parasite. That is, it lives in its host without killing its host, right? If you're a virus, you want to have a nice warm body to live in, but you don't want to kill the body, because if the body dies, you die also, right? So a successful parasite doesn't kill you. And in fact, monkeys can live with SIV in their blood. It makes them a little sick, but they can live with it. Right around 1930 or 1935, the virus mutated and it became infectious to human beings. So in other words, SIV turned into HIV. And not only did it become infectious to human beings, but it became fatal, so that when it did infect people, it would kill them. So somewhere there in the 30s, it jumped species. And it may have jumped species several times. And how did it jump? I mean, it could have been as simple as someone killing a monkey and getting contaminated with some of the blood, someone eating a monkey, some of these monkeys are eaten, someone getting bitten. You know, it's unclear, but somehow or another, people were living together in the forest, and the virus jumped. And this is the interesting thing about HIV, because things evolve all the time. The interesting thing was that even though it probably jumped species almost 80 years ago, it didn't really come out of Africa for another 50 years. It really wasn't until the mid-1970s that it managed to work its way out of Central Africa to the rest of the world. And the reason why, and this is a little counterintuitive, is it turns out that HIV is actually a very weak virus. It's very hard to get. You can't sneeze on someone and give it to them. Even if you have sex with someone, if you're healthy, you tend not to get it. It's actually quite hard to get to normal heterosexual intercourse. It's a very delicate virus that quickly dies when exposed to air, so it's not airborne. In fact, it's not even waterborne. It really has to, it can't, it's not strong enough to penetrate intact human skin, so there really has to be an open sore or wound. This is not a robust virus. And then remember, the part of the world that it evolved in is a very isolated part of the world. You didn't have modern highways. You didn't have airports. So it wasn't as if there was a lot of human contact between the people who initially got it and the rest of the world. And the best theory we have right now of how it actually got out of Africa was that Haitian mercenaries, hired soldiers, were sent over to some of these Central African countries in the 50s and 60s to help fight the wars. There were all sorts of civil wars and rebels and skirmishes, and they went over, and somehow they picked it up over there, probably through sex, and they brought it back to Haiti. And then in the 1970s, Port-au-Prince, the capital of Haiti, emerged as a real gay tourist destination. There was sort of very lack law enforcement. There were no vice squads. There was male prostitution. It was pretty free, and it was considered sort of a safe and stable place for gay men to go and have fun and have vacation. And gay men in the U.S. picked it up in Haiti, and they brought it back to Los Angeles and New York and San Francisco, and then it really exploded starting the late 1970s, early 1980s. So it had been around for quite a time, but it hadn't gone anywhere. And then all of a sudden, when it hit the Western world, it exploded.
That's amazing that it was in parts of Africa for decades and didn't go anywhere.
Yeah, in fact, there are very odd stories. For example, once we discovered HIV, right around 1983, 84, and we realized what it was, we started looking back at old medical records, and we realized that there were these isolated cases of people who had died mysteriously that had probably died of AIDS, but at the time we didn't know it. For example, there's a well-known case of a pilot, a solo pilot, who crash-landed in Zaire, that was the Belgian Congo, and was treated with a blood transfusion at a hospital in Kinshasa, and then went on his way and flew to Canada. And then 5 years later, all of a sudden, his entire immune system collapsed and he died. And at the time, this was just, it was one of these ones for the medical textbooks. Who could figure out what it was? It was sort of unprecedented. We realized in retrospect, the guy had probably picked up AIDS in his 2 days in the hospital in Kinshasa. There were a couple other ones. There's a story of a kid in St. Louis who died in the 1950s. There was several people in Great Britain. There were a bunch of nuns, Belgian nuns, who died. They'd probably been down doing missionary work in the Belgian Congo and picked it up maybe through infected blood transfusions or something and brought it back. But at the time, no one knew what it was. We just knew that these were some of these inexplicable deaths. People die. We don't always know what they're dying of. Yes. And in retrospect, we realized that it had made it out of Africa periodically in teeny little cohorts, but that didn't really explode out until the 70s.
Jonathan Engel is our guest. His new book, The Epidemic, A Global History of AIDS. Jonathan, I can remember being back in college in the 80s when, boy, they just put the fear of God into you back then. This is like 84, 85. And I remember any time the college got kids together, this was mentioned. And it was like, by the way, we just want to remind you, there's something out there now called AIDS. And I remember a friend of mine who was a biology major said that when they can cure AIDS, they'll be able to cure cancer because they operate so similarly. Is that accurate?
No.
Okay. Well, he's a lawyer today, so there you go.
A couple things. First of all, because I remember that too. I was in college also. AIDS and cancer are very, very different. Cancer is about the growth genes in cells, that is what one of the things that happens in all cells is that they have to grow, and there are very strong little switches that turn genes on and turn genes off. And the problem with cancer is that you start having cells that suddenly start to grow and multiply, and you can't seem to find the off switch. One of the big mysteries right now is trying to figure out where the off switch is. In fact, there's an article in today's Science Times that we think that just ordinary moles and freckles are really the beginnings of cancer, and that but for some reason or other, they do find the off switch.
It was
so
arrested
instead of
the mole
growing
into
a cancerous tumor, it turns off, right? By contrast, AIDS is something very different. It's really just a good old-fashioned infectious disease. It's like mumps or smallpox or the common cold or the flu. And some of them are caused by bacteria. Some of them are caused by viruses. This is actually a specific class of virus. It's called a retrovirus, and it's a slow-growing retrovirus. But it's not the only one. There are other ones also. A virus is an incredibly simple organism. It's so simple that some people don't even classify it as a living thing. It is simply a piece of genetic material, either RNA or DNA. In this case, it's RNA, not DNA, but it could be either one, surrounded by a protein coat, and that's all it is. It's so simple that unlike a bacteria, it can't even really live by itself. It's almost kind of like a freeze-dried living thing. You have to add water before the thing wakes up. Unlike a bacteria, which is clearly alive, it's swimming around and eating and pooping and doing things that living things do. A virus isn't doing any of that until it gets inside another animal's cell. And then it can inject its genetic material into the cell's mechanisms, and it gets the cell to start producing for it. I one time said to someone, it's a little bit like as if you needed to produce guns or cannons or something, and instead of building your own factory, you got into the computer networks of your enemy's factory and got those machines to start making guns for you. You kind of appropriated someone else's machinery through sabotage. That's what a virus does.
It just takes over the cell.
Yeah, it takes over the cell, and it gets the cell to do its work for it. And to get rid of the virus, you got to kill it. The problem is that it's very easy to kill a virus. You just douse it with bleach or chlorine or something like that. The problem is that most things that kill a virus also kill a person. That's the big mystery is, how do you kill the virus without killing the person?
What's the most promising line of research from your work on your book, the most promising line of research in terms of a cure?
The most promising line is continued work on what we already have, which is combination therapy. What people dream about is a vaccine. When you get a vaccine that really works, like smallpox, it changes the world. It's cheap, it's 100% effective, and it's just very easy to dispense. It's highly unlikely that we're going to find a vaccine for this thing soon. It turns out it's a very, very tricky, wily virus. It mutates very, very fast. Every time you can get a vaccine that works in part, it seems to quickly mutate its way into a different form, which is resistant to the vaccine. Even though we've had enormous investment in vaccine research for 20 years now, we're just not getting close to anything. There's really nothing that I know of that's even close to being testable in human beings. We're a long way away. But on the promising end, for over 10 years now, we've had these very, very effective combination therapies. And although they're not perfect, they're getting better all the time. We're developing new pills all the time, new antiviral medications all the time. We're developing new combinations. There's now the most recent thing I just saw just in the last 2 months is they've actually come out with a one once-a-day pill as opposed to 20 or 30 different pills that most people are taking, which in certain cases may actually be a reasonable regimen for some people. So, I mean, that's incredible that we've now gotten this down to one pill. It's not a perfect pill yet, and it's still sort of in the development pipeline, but we're getting there. All of these things are imperfect. That is, you still have AIDS, and if you stop taking the medicine, you would die. It's a little bit like diabetes. You can control it for a long time with insulin, but that's not quite the same as curing your diabetes. On the other hand, you can live for a long time on insulin injections, and you can live for a long time on combination therapy. It may not be perfect, but I think it's probably the most promising way to go, to keep getting that more perfect.
Medical historian Jonathan Engel is our guest this hour on Charlottesville Right Now. His new book is The Epidemic: A Global History of AIDS. We're going to take a break for a few minutes, a little local news and weather here at the bottom of the hour. You're listening to Charlottesville Right Now. We have the honor and pleasure today of talking with Jonathan Engel. He's a medical historian and the author of a new book, The Epidemic: A Global History of AIDS. And this is the whole thing, ladies and gentlemen, from front to back, everything you always wanted to know, and then some, I can promise you that. It's a fantastic book, and Jonathan joins us on the long line from his office in New Jersey. Thank you again for spending some time with us today.
Sure, my pleasure.
Jonathan, what was the most, because I'm guessing like anybody else, like an educated guy out there, you were already familiar with a lot of this sort of broad strokes history of AIDS and some of the issues, but when you started really doing the research and doing the interviews and reading the old newspaper articles, what was the most surprising thing that you came across? Maybe even a few surprising things that really made you stop.
Sure. I mean, a couple things. You're right. Because I sort of grew up with this epidemic, I knew a lot of it, and a lot of what I found out doing research confirmed what I thought I knew. But on some stuff I really didn't know. For example, to really get down and dirty into the gay community and the way it defined itself and the way it saw itself in the early 80s and the way it organized. That was just fascinating. I mean, one of the big things that comes out in the book is the level of sexual promiscuity in the American homosexual community in the early 1980s. They were incredible statistics that came out. Median annual sex partners of over 100, which is really a staggering number when you think about it. Lifetime numbers of sex partners in the 400 or 500, even up to 1,000.
Oh my God!
Yeah, I mean, really, but it's true. I mean, it's just simply true. It's very difficult to try to understand what was going on. And when you looked in, you began to look at some of the voices coming out of there and leaders in the gay community and people who really tried to articulate what it was to be gay. One of the things they talked about again and again was the importance of sex in defining themselves. I mean, we all like sex. It's an important part of life. But most of us don't think of defining ourselves through sex, of an act of sex. It's just sort of something you do and part of intimacy, or sometimes not so much intimacy. But for the gay community, it represented more than just something fun. It represented a kind of liberation and a sort of a validation of who they were. They felt like they'd come out of the closet after 1969 and the famous Stonewall riots in New York City, and that the ability to have sex with whomever and whenever they wanted, this was a part of being a liberated, sort of self-respectable gay man. And that once AIDS reared its head in the early 80s, and people had to begin to stop having so much sex, it wasn't just that they had to curtail a lifestyle, it was almost they had to redefine themselves. If being gay wasn't about just having a lot of sex, then what was it about? And I find that so interesting, because I would have thought, well, being gay is about being intimate with men as opposed to being intimate with women. But it was more than about intimacy. It was about a way of expressing yourself. And there were a lot of fights within the gay community. They were actually, even one of the most obvious responses to AIDS was, for example, to close the bathhouses. Bathhouses were these private, for-profit institutions where you could go in the evening and come in with $10, $15. You got an entrance fee, you got a towel and a locker. And then you basically sat around naked. You could have sex with whoever you wanted. There were cubicles, there were rooms, there were baths, and you could really couple and copulate with several people a night. There were orgies, and these were profitable, and people liked them. And for many, many gays, this was really almost the center of social life, and the ability to go to a bathhouse was an important part about being a liberated gay man. When it became clear that you ought to close these things, people were dying of AIDS. I mean, thousands of gay men all of a sudden were getting this horrible disease and dying. No one knew what it was. But clearly, you had to stop having sex with so many people. And yet, there were men in the gay community who stood up and said, we shouldn't close them. That to close down the bathhouses is to drive us back into the closet. It's to bring us back into the 1950s. And it was so, I mean, it's just common sense would dictate. You got to save your life. I mean, before you can be liberated, you got to be alive. And let's put a padlock on these things. And yet there was a lot of protest and a lot of debate in the community about whether or not this was the right thing to do.
What do you think has been the result on that very community that had this argument 25 years ago?
The gay community is interesting. It took them a little while to kind of to get it, to understand the incredible threat that was facing them. Once they got it, and it happened pretty fast, say within 3 or 4 years, they responded with a level of efficacy that has been not repeated anywhere else. The gay community was phenomenal in what they did. They're an exemplar of what a functioning community does. They took responsibility for their problems. They created political action groups. They created self-help groups. They created clinics. They lobbied for research. They protested for more congressional action. And more than anything, they educated themselves. They didn't wait for the government to come in and save them. They created educational materials and pamphlets and books and lectures and seminars. And they really said, we have to take care of ourselves. And if we're going to stop dying, it's because we're going to change the way we live and we're going to change the way we have sex. And they did it on a dime. When you look at how hard it is to get people to change their sexual behavior, it's one of the things that's almost impossible to get people to change is what they eat and how they have sex. And yet the gay community turned it around on a dime. Within a decade, they had totally changed the way they interacted sexually with each other.
Phone lines are open, folks. It's 977-1070. If you have a comment or a question for our guest today, Jonathan Engel. His new book is The Epidemic, A Global History of AIDS. Jonathan, another angle in your book that you really take on here is the political angle and what were elected leaders doing. Tell us, what do you think America did right and what did we really do wrong?
We actually got more right than you would think. And in fact, if I came out with any a conclusion that might be a little contentious. It's that Ronald Reagan, who was really vilified in the 80s, particularly by the gay community, but by the public health community in general, people said he was a homophobe, he was conservative, he was a genocidal a maniac who was killing hundreds of thousands of people because he refused to fund AIDS or anything. In fact, it turns out that just wasn't true. The Reagan administration started throwing a lot of money into AIDS research very, very fast. By as early as 1985, 1986, really when a lot of the country wasn't even aware that this was an epidemic, yet it was already the best financed disease in the NIH on a per case basis. In other words, cancer was actually getting more funding than AIDS. On the other hand, the number of people dying from cancer was 1,000 times as many people as the number dying of AIDS each year. So the Reagan administration actually started putting money into research very early. They made it a top priority very early. As early as 1985, the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare under Reagan came out and publicly said AIDS is our top priority. The Centers for Disease Control, which is the big public health network down there in Atlanta, that made AIDS a top priority. It's a little bit, you have to separate the man from the administration. Reagan as an individual clearly was, I don't know if I want to use the word homophobic, but he was certainly uncomfortable with gays. He was uncomfortable, I think, with many marginal people. You know, he was really a real middle American, grew up in small town Illinois, lived the American dream. You know, he had very, very conventional norms in his life, and people who pressed the boundaries of alternative lifestyles made him very uncomfortable. And so I think on a personal level, he wasn't comfortable with gays. He didn't really want to associate himself with them. On the other hand, if you look at what his administration did, they really did the right thing. And I don't want to say that Reagan, the individual, promulgated all this funding, but he certainly didn't stop it either. I mean, he ultimately had to sign off on the budget.
Yeah, exactly.
And when the budget was presented to him, he didn't say no, cut off the AIDS funding. He didn't. He listened to the words of his advisors and his health advisors, and he signed the bills.
Let's go to the phones. Jeff is on line two. Jeff, you're on with Jonathan Engel. Go right ahead.
Good afternoon. My only comment was that I thought that the program was so fascinating and so well delivered, I would love this guest to come back and talk about a whole bunch of other medical history as well. I just find it fascinating.
Well, thank you so much. Jonathan, do you think we could work that out at some point?
I'd be happy to. That's a lovely thing to hear.
I think it would be great. Maybe we can get Jonathan to be a monthly guest on this program and just sort of talk about a little medical history now and then.
Let me know when he's on.
Absolutely. Thanks for the call, Jeff. Jonathan, what did we do wrong?
What we did in our own country, we really got almost entirely right. We put a huge amount of research in. We educated people. We stopped it. We got something a little bit wrong in this country, which is that we told straight people that they were in great danger of getting AIDS, even though we knew that they weren't. Even though really quite early on in the epidemic, say by the mid to late 80s, we knew that straight people were not going to get it the same way gay people were. Straight people don't have 100 sex partners a year. And it turns out it's actually much, much harder to get AIDS through vaginal intercourse than through anal intercourse. And we knew that quite early, too. And yet we didn't really, for a variety of reasons, we didn't want to tell the public. We wanted the public to be as frightened as they could be, rather than feeling as sort of safe as they could be, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if we would say we got that wrong, but it was a little bit of misinformation that was consciously disseminated. I think what we got really wrong as a world, not just as a country, was we didn't understand the depth of the epidemic in Africa early enough. Even as the epidemic was lodging itself in the gay population here and also in heroin users, IV drug users, mostly heroin users, we saw that. What we didn't understand was that it was actually very, very different in Africa, that in Africa a lot of straight people were getting it, partially because that didn't seem to make sense. How could straight people essentially not get it here, but they could get it in Africa? And it took us a long time to figure that out, why sex actually seemed to be a little different in Africa than here. And we didn't understand how broadly it was spreading and really how devastating it was going to be. Now, even if we'd known, I'm not sure how much we could have done. It's very hard to tell other countries how to live their lives.
Yeah,
we know that. We've been putting really billions of dollars into poor countries now since the 50s through the IMF and through the World Bank and through the UN. You know, we do our best. And we know that often it doesn't do much good. Often it gets skimmed off or it doesn't go to the right people, or even if it goes to the right people, they don't really know how to spend it. Just because you know there's a need, and even if you have the money, it's not always easy to solve the problem. But I think if we'd understood it earlier, we might have tried to reach out to these countries a little earlier and help them. As it turned out, we've been totally ineffective in stopping this disease in Africa.
And the worst, do you think the worst is yet to be seen when it comes to the fallout? that we're going to see from the numbers of people dying and what we were talking about earlier in this hour, all the orphans that are going to be created in the third world.
Right. I think we're going to see, I mean, in a continent and in countries that are already very unstable, you know, and politically chaotic, I think we're going to see greater chaos. I think there's going to be long-term social and economic fallout from this. And the other thing that people aren't talking about, the two biggest rising epidemics are the ones in India and China. And first of all, we just don't know. We have very, very poor figures. I mean, China is mum. They won't tell us what's going on there. I would say there's no danger of political chaos in China. They're a pretty ordered place. But there's certainly kind of a human disaster unfolding.
Sure.
And India, we just don't know yet. Africa is the great tragedy, but there's so many tragic things about Africa. There's just so many things. The continent has so much potential, and yet so many things have gone wrong over the last 100 or even 300 years there. And this is just the latest, the long line of it. We've done some good things. Even I know a lot of people who are interested in AIDS and public health don't like our current president. You know, people who tend to be interested in public health tend not to like conservative Republicans. That's a generalization. And yet the fact is this current president pledged $15 billion to AIDS relief in Africa, which is unprecedented. You have to give people credit, even if you don't like people, and even if you don't trust their motives, I think you do have to give them credit where credit's due.
Absolutely.
This president is trying to do the right thing on that. He's not been particularly effective at getting the money over there, but I think he was quite honest. I think his intentions were there, and we're trying to figure out how to get the money over there. I think more interesting, actually, right now, the Gates Foundation, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, is, you know, it's massive. It's $30 billion in principle.
Yeah, yeah.
And they've just gotten another $30 billion from Warren Buffett, so it's $60 billion, which is about six times bigger than the next biggest foundation, which is the Ford Foundation with $10 billion. So it's a huge pool of money. And Gates himself and his wife are very, very interested in AIDS and third world diseases and health prevention, and they have really pledged to put the full weight of their foundation behind this. I'll be curious to see if they can do it. I don't think, even if you have $1 billion to spend or even $3 billion to spend, it's not so easy to figure out how to do this. We know why Africans get AIDS. It's because they sleep around. Mostly because they sleep with prostitutes.
Yeah,
that's pretty cheap to stop, right? You could put the prostitutes in jail, or you could just tell people to stop having sex with prostitutes. It's easy enough to say it. It's actually very, very hard to do it. How do you do that? How do you actually get in there? It doesn't matter how much money you have. How do you get people to stop doing this? And if you interview Africans, they know they're in danger of getting AIDS. If you talk to the men, they know they can get AIDS, and they do it anyway. How do you change someone's entire mindset? It's not just about money. It's about re-educating an entire culture, and I'm not sure we can do that, and even if we could, I'm not sure it's our place. Is it really our place as Americans to go into other countries and tell them how to live their lives? There's no easy answer to that, but to a certain degree, you kind of have to let people screw up their lives on their own or fix their lives on their own.
His name is Jonathan Engel, folks, medical historian. The book is The Epidemic, A Global History of AIDS, and I want everybody to go out and buy one. It's a fantastic book. And, Jonathan, we look forward to talking to you again.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure being on your program.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Jonathan Engel, the book is The Epidemic. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back. This is Charlottesville Right Now.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SeavillePodcast.com for more.